Oh, recording in progress.
I've called somebody Mr. since I was 7.
All right. Welcome back. Yeah, yeah. Please. All right. Well, welcome back to our third installment of our journey through art and as an analogy, so to speak, of spiritual insight. Is my clicker working? Turn it on first. I cannot read it from back here. I changed up the verse a little bit today. This is actually one of our scriptures from service today. So I'll let you kind of read it on your own, but I'm just going to highlight a couple things. One, this idea of, you know, kind of a human way of knowing versus a spiritual way of knowing, which I've been highlighting through the Corinthians passage lately. Paul here says, I'm speaking in human terms because of your natural limitations. So there's still kind of that, you know, you guys aren't getting it yet, so I'll speak down to you a little bit. But I brought this up because the idea of, you know, we're servants to something. Here, Paul brings up we're either servants to sin or of obedience. We'll look at some different ways of subservience in an artistic context today to kind of highlight that. So, okay. So what is art? I put up a few of the answers that you guys spoke out last week. Ideas of paying attention, visual, verbal, or musical interpretation, representation of the creator's impression, and then what isn't art? It's a way of seeing. So I'm hoping today's little journey here will kind of highlight some of these different aspects of what is art. But first, for this, we're going to need a little bit of historical context. So back in 1889, there was the World's Fair. The World's Fair had been going on since 1851, I think was the first one. And so every year there was like this World's Fair that was supposed to highlight the industrial capabilities and the latest and greatest in science and technology and stuff in different places. And in 1889, it was in Paris. And the highlight of that fair was the unveiling of this new structure, the Eiffel Tower. Kind of a symbol of kind of the power and the promise of industrialization, entering into the machine age, as they called it. It was kind of telling that Gustav Eiffel, one of the designers, was an engineer, not an architect. And in fact, the actual curvature of the tower itself is essentially based on mathematical formulas for wind resistance and at that elevation hitting the materials at that point. So it's all very evocative of technology, industry, and was kind of the theme of, you know, going into the turn of the century. Also relatively new on the scene was travel by train. And all of this created differing viewpoints. Up until then, especially in terms of art, you had perspective that was kind of mastered in the Renaissance, so like 1100s, 1200s. And art was based on that perspective rendering, right? The vanishing point of you look off in the distance at a road and it converges to a point on the horizon. And all art was kind of based on that type of setup. But with being up super high in the Eiffel Tower, you could look down and he had a whole different view of the world around you. It was now more, I mean, you still have some perspective, I guess, going off in the distance, but you see kind of an aerial view, in essence, that's more about pattern. And you see the shapes that the roads and paths and buildings make on the ground. And then the view by train that you wouldn't get on a horse and carriage because you're traveling much faster. Something that we're so used to, traveling by car, traveling by train. But back then, I mean, that was a very new perspective. Especially when you have stuff right next to the train traveling super fast and then the stuff off in the distance moving slower. Very different experience, right, of the world around you. And of course, anytime you have a change, technological, cultural, otherwise, that's going to give more kind of food for thought for artists to start looking at and expressing. And so, one of the first artists to really start to play around with the different changing views is an artist named Paul Cézanne. We'll just look at a couple of his pieces here. He's often called the father of abstract art, even though none of his work is abstract. You got, you know, some draperies with some apples, oranges, fruit, you know, porcelain jugs and stuff like that. Landscape pieces. But he really started playing around with this idea of just changing how one sees. So some quotes from here. I must tell you, as a painter, I'm becoming more clear-sighted before nature. So the idea of the artist himself changing, right? Becoming more clear-sighted, the way that you see things changing. But with me, the realization of my sensations is always painful. I cannot attain the intensity that is unfolded before my senses. I do not have the richness of coloring that animates nature. So you can maybe start to get a sense, both visually and in his quotes, that it's more about the effect, right? The visual effect that he's having. And not so much trying to paint a picture of mountains, trees, landscape, fruit, whatever, but more trying to depict the visual experience and the intensity and the emotions that's creating within him. Yeah, it's almost kind of more from his theory and his ideas and the letters that he wrote to other artists that you get these ideas that he still used in a pretty illustrative way. I mean, this one's getting a little bit more abstract, though.
Michael?
Yeah. The question was, is that where, like, the abstract is coming from?
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's often referred to as the father of abstract art because perhaps more of his ideas that he spoke about and less having actual abstract pictures. Although this one's getting, you know, quite a bit abstract. But still, studying nature. Let us go forth to study beautiful nature. Let us try to express ourselves according to our personal temperament. Time and reflection, moreover, modify little by little our vision. And at last, comprehension comes to us. But one is more or less master of one's method, and above all, the means of expression. Get to the heart of what is before you, and continue to express yourself as logically as possible. So, again, very little talk of what it is that he's painting, right? It says, it doesn't really matter what you're painting, just get to the heart of what it is before you. And I think by that, it's more about getting to know yourself and the sensations that you're getting from whatever it is you're in front of. And then with these different means of expression, express yourself, not necessarily the object that you're painting, but you're expressing yourself as logically as possible. Yeah?
I guess that last comment. Sorry, I don't have Kevin's mouth looking.
Do we need a mic?
So what struck me when you were talking, and then to the last couple of words there, where it said, you know, get to the heart of what is before you, and then express yourself as logically. And I guess that logically, being married to you, doesn't surprise me, but yet surprises me, because everybody thinks that art is so emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it feels like when he was talking, it is not about emotion. It is, there is this science,
yeah,
logic, brain, which I guess is, I'm curious because if other people feel this way, but that's not what I think of when I think of art, is logical, and
yeah,
yet a lot
especially
of
art, his part too.
Yeah, and yet, I mean, I've heard other quotes, he kept talking about lot, like he, mm-hmm, he very much viewed it as very logical. I don't know if you wanted to expand on that. I'm just curious. It confuses my brain.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll continue that theme a little bit moving forward. But yeah, art as a means of communication, as a form of expression, artists put a lot of thought into how they're doing that. A lot of reflection of looking, trying to analyze what the picture is saying back to them, and becomes kind of a dialogue or kind of a form of argumentation. So there is very much a left brain logical side to it. But it's different, you know. You know, logic usually has kind of propositions, right? You state something, and then you try to argue for that position, or trying to convince somebody of something and offer some sort of proof. For art, there's a lot of, I guess, the data that you're creating an argument with are the physical sensations that you're picking up on, either from what you're trying to paint, you know, whether it's a landscape or a still life or a person or something like that. And then the sensations coming off from the painting as it's developing. Then you take all that into account and literally analyze whether or not it's saying what you're trying to convey. So
tear that out.
Yeah.
And it's, I feel like that's the same thing in art. Like, yes, there's this logic that art history teachers and art professors, mm-hmm, tell us. And then yet it's like you have to know that so that then you can throw that out.
Yeah, to some extent. Yeah.
Because it's somewhat subjective, right? Just because one person says it is doesn't mean it is.
Yeah. So you start having, you know, an acknowledgement of multiple perspectives. So the whole idea of perspective, right, in an artistic sense, where you have this means of, and it was actually pretty scientific, a means of laying out a picture to make everything look like it's receding back into space, right, to be illusionistically correct. At the same time, was a very singular perspective. Right? There are some paintings that are in cathedrals or museums where they actually have a marker or a different colored tile on the floor. And that's where you're supposed to stand in order for all the perspective to line up for the picture that you're looking at. And so with this time period and the changing viewpoints that you had from, you know, first time having kind of an aerial view to some extent of the city that you're in at the top of the Eiffel Tower, to you know, the fast-moving motion from train travel, things like that. It's you're starting to get a shift in perspective, right? No longer is it just going to be a single point where you can stand and look at something, but you're going to start looking at things from multiple perspectives. And that multiple perspectives, right, that individual expression that Cezanne is starting to bring to the forefront. So a couple of these means of expressions that Cezanne talked about are form, which has to do with shapes and lines, versus color. And historically, there was kind of a battle between these two elements of art that came about within the relationship of two massively famous artists, Picasso and Matisse. So we'll check out Matisse first. He came first in 1905. He exhibited this picture called The Joy of Life. I think you can go see this in Pennsylvania somewhere. Apparently it's pretty big. I haven't seen it in person, but it's like 2.5 meters wide. So it's a pretty big painting. So the art world back then, you had generally like the Paris Academy of Art would put on this annual exhibition, and you had to send in pictures, and there was like juries, and you had to, you know, be chosen to be in one of these exhibits. Well, then you get a group of artists that were like, no, we don't like that institutional aspect, so we're going to start our own show called the Salon of Independence, basically. But then they had their own juries and stuff like that. They were still just as exclusive. And Matisse was able to get this painting in because he was actually on the committee. And so it was allowed to go in without being through the jury process. And the head of the committee, who was a well-known artist at that time, did not like this picture whatsoever. Would not have allowed it to be in. I think he actually tried to pick a fight with Matisse after the show, after the opening of the show, in a cafe when they all went to have their drinks and stuff afterwards. Got pretty heated. So, but Matisse was, interestingly enough, taking off from Cezanne, right? Getting to this idea of these means of expression, and for him it was color, and getting to the expression of himself and his sensations, more than trying to depict a realistic image or scene. And so that Matisse and a couple other artists, the reviewers called Les Fauves, which means wild beasts. They were kind of denigrated as like these, you know, rebels that, you know, color is just like in your face. But really kind of broke away, and it was one of those things where it's like, you know, you had to get some champions for it. Some people, they didn't like it at first, but one particular collector like forced himself to have an open mind and went back and looked at it over and over and finally realized, you know, this is a pretty important piece. And then he bought it. So, but anyway, so this is one route, breaking off from Cezanne, looking at color. Well, then along comes Picasso a couple years later, and he kind of thinks to himself, well, Matisse did the color thing. I'm going to play with form. And so this piece caused just as much stir, and it wasn't even exhibited in like a public exhibit for several years after it was painted. But word got around, and all the major artists would go to his studio and check this out. And this time it was Matisse who was really ticked off at this painting and thought Picasso was just breaking all, you know, forms of whatever was true and right about the art world, and said he was going to make Picasso pay for this hoax. And so, I mean, it's like, yeah. Yeah, they are fighting words. So, I mean, there was a lot of emotion and a lot of, I mean, fighting. So if, like, you don't understand these works or you don't get them or you don't have an appreciation for them, you're in good company with major artists that didn't like them at first either. So a couple things with Picasso. We'll kind of go through him first and then go back to Matisse. These are a couple portraits that Picasso painted. One's a self-portrait and one is a portrait of Gertrude Stein. Gertrude and her brother Leo were Americans living in Paris and kind of were early supporters of some of the more, you know, avant-garde abstract art coming out. In fact, the one guy I just mentioned that forced himself to keep an open mind about Matisse's painting, that was Leo Stein, her brother, that bought that piece. And they would have all the artists and writers and philosophers at their house on a weekly basis, have these, you know, meet and greets and talking about all the latest ideas and stuff like that. So that's where Picasso and Matisse met and started their friendship / rivalry. But one thing that really happened with Picasso, and I'll read, I think these are like actually his own words, but he went to a museum located in the Palace of the Trocadero, I guess is what it's called. And there was having an exhibit of African tribal art, masks and different things, cultural artifacts. And it really struck him. So he says, "When I went to the old Trocadero, it was disgusting. The flea market, the smell, I was all alone. I wanted to get away, but I didn't leave. I stayed. I understood that it was very important. Something was happening to me, right? The masks weren't just like any other pieces of sculpture. Not at all. They were magic things. The Negro pieces were intercessors or mediators. Ever since then, I've known the word in French. They were against everything, against unknown threatening spirits. I always looked at fetishes. I understood. I, too, am against everything. I, too, believe that everything is unknown, that everything is an enemy. Everything. Not the details, women, children, babies, tobacco, playing, but the whole of it. I understood what the Negroes used their sculpture for. They were weapons. To help people avoid coming under the influence of spirits again, to help them become independent. They're tools. If we give spirits a form, we become independent. I understood why I was a painter." So he had this, you know, pretty profound personal experience of kind of coming to grips for himself personally what art was for. And for him, it became quasi religious in the sense of weapons against the evil spirits, as he called them. So you might notice on these portraits here how the faces are kind of mask-like, especially the eyes, very much like the African mask that he was seeing, and incorporated them into this piece here. And you start having this idea of shifting perspectives, right? If you look at this, it's not like a perspective window into a room, but you kind of have shifting viewpoints and figures that are more or less realistic, and then others that are verging more on these kind of African tribal mask-looking things, and it just kind of breaks everything apart. And he starts playing around with the idea more. And perhaps you can get a sense of kind of a vortex of motion, this spinning around. You know, if when we look at objects, right? Like, I look at this chair. I understand it's the same chair, even if I'm over here looking at it from this perspective, right? But the two views are completely different. And so part of the idea with cubism is this idea of how can you, on a two-dimensional surface, recreate something that's three-dimensional? And perspective is one answer to that, the illusion of what does it look like from this perspective where I'm standing. Cubism was another idea of taking, let me see if I can take all the different perspectives. If you're looking at it, if you're spinning around it in a circle, and all of the views kind of meld together. Just remember, a great way that I illustrated this with my other students, I would take a Rubik's Cube because it was small and square. But if you take, especially as a squarish object, and toss it up in the air and spin it, right? And you try to look at what it looks like as it's spinning, right? It's spinning so fast that your eyes can't take in every single view. And so you get all these different views of it kind of blended together in your eye, and you'll get very much the idea of a cubist painting here. So, and he was also still very much influenced by Cezanne, and especially if I can jump back, you know, this piece is where Cezanne, especially the paint, just becomes each brushstroke is almost like a different surface at a different angle, breaking up this three-dimensional space into, you know, individual flat planes, and that's exactly what Picasso was after. So you kind of have this break, also coming off of the technology of the camera. Camera was invented in the late 1800s, and now there was no longer a need necessarily for artists to paint realistic-looking pictures because you had this machine that could do it for you. And so really, artists felt freed up to explore these different means, and the two principal means for painting is the form, the shapes that you use, and the colors, and how can we play those, play with those to express something that you can't really take a picture of, right? Which is the intensity of the feelings and the emotions that you get when you're looking at something. So it freed him up. He's since explored several different styles that are all different but all the same at the same time, often incorporating multiple viewpoints. And some critic realized that each change in his style corresponded with who was his mistress at that time. So here we have, I have a few examples, a kind of more curvilinear style when he was in love with, dating, messing around with Maria Therese Walter. Francois Gillot, who is the mother of a couple of his children. So there's a portrait of her, and then her playing with the kids. Dora Maar, around the time of the Weeping Women that we looked at previously. You know, still, you kind of have a profile face and frontal view of the eyes. So you have these multiple perspectives being kind of blended together. Jacqueline Roche. It's similar in one sense, but each time there's kind of some distinct characteristics. And he was quoted one time saying, "I paint women not as I see them, but as I think of them." And he was not a very good guy, I'll be honest. In fact, so here we have a pretty realistic painting early on. If you look at the shadow if you're looking at it, to the left of her face, where the shadow ends is kind of his profile. You can see his nose and lips. I don't know how clearly you can see it from there. The artist presence, right? Kind of controlling his woman. Here we have a scene where he's coming into a woman lying on the bed. It's his shadow projecting forward. I don't think he viewed women very kindly. I don't know if he viewed himself very kindly in his interactions with women, but it really... So that's a struggle, right? Lately, there's been a lot of hubbub the last few years. Comedian Hannah Gadsby talking... they studied art. Now they're comedian. They just curated a show of Picasso's paintings to kind of illustrate their perspective on Picasso. And it is troubling. What do you do when there's an artist or any sort of public figure that is despicable in terms of morals and how they treat people, and yet they produce things that have such a profound effect on society in a positive way, right? I don't know. I don't really have an answer for that. I think the idea of him with that experience with the African masks, where he felt like these are weapons against these evil spirits, I think he was very deeply aware of the evil spirits haunting him. And so, you know, is he thinking of these women in horrendous terms, or is he fighting against the demons that manifest themselves in his relationship with women? I often think of, there's, I don't know what biblical verse it is, but there's a phrase one time where God talks about his servant, Nebuchadnezzar. Right? Nebuchadnezzar was prime enemy number one of the Israelites, right? And yet, he's referred to at one point as God's servant, Nebuchadnezzar. The only thing I can take from that is that God can use anyone, anybody, anything for his purposes. And so, that's what I try to keep in mind when supporting art of artists that I wouldn't necessarily support in person, right? It's complicated. All right. So here's a quote by him, though, and I like this little sequence here because you kind of get to see art being made. But he talks about, it would be very interesting to record photographically, not the stages of a painting, but its metamorphoses. One would see perhaps by what course a mind finds its way towards the crystallization of its dream. But what is really very serious is to see that the picture does not change basically, that the initial vision remains almost intact in spite of appearance. So, he let a photographer at one point have access into his studio and started making a painting, and he let the photographer just kind of click away. And so we can kind of see several stages of this painting that he's creating. And then there's the standing back and reflecting on it, and then going in and almost destroying quite a bit of it, changing it around. The essential profile stays the same, but a lot of the details switch over. Eyes are painted out, repainted in different places. Areas are completely colored out. Eyes become ears, different lines here and there. And then still some further reflection. You get way far away, you get your sketchbook, you make little sketches, different alternate paths you can take until he finally realizes this is what I was after. So that idea in the Romans passage about, you know, being a servant either of sin or of obedience, being a servant of something, right? Artists are essentially servants of their sensations, their thoughts, their impressions, and they're servants to their paintings, in the sense of working on it, changing it, shifting it until the lines, colors, shapes add up to what they're experiencing internally. But Picasso didn't always get it either. We'll go back to Matisse. This is a book, by the way, written by Francoise Gillot, which was one of his mistresses, mother of a couple of his children. She was a huge fan of Matisse, but she was in love with Picasso. And they would often visit Matisse, and so she had some fascinating insight into their interaction with each other, their art. So I'll read a little bit about what she wrote about this painting here. Then we began to discuss Matisse's Red Still Life with Magnolia of 1941. Picasso found it too decorative. Furthermore, the open composition with the copper cauldron partly out of the picture and the objects barely touching each other, not isolated or intersecting, frankly, was anathema to the master of cubism. It set his teeth on edge. Not so with me. I found the unexpected juxtaposition of elements rather intriguing, inasmuch as it did not deter the whole from achieving unity. It was true that there was a total disregard for classical composition, at least as far as the rules of Western art were concerned. There was a complete lack of rhetoric in the exposition of the theme. The relationship of one object to another was neither logical nor contrived. It just happened. It was mysterious, irrational. I wondered how such balance was achieved. It obviously had nothing to do with a conceptual geometry of space. Notice all this language that's very logical sounding, right? Analyzing this here. I guessed that the bold interplay of colors, the exquisite balance of qualities and quantities, and the linear design had enough architectonic strength to make any rational connection appear unnecessary and obsolete. I glanced back at the Red Still Life. It was radiant, full of bliss, and yet elusive. It was impossible to analyze why it worked. It continued outside the boundaries of the canvas. It completed itself in the mind of the beholder, like an intuition of joy. It had some of the aspects of a mandala, the mystic diagram of the East, a map for the journey of the soul. The positive shapes and the negative space coexisted. Nothing came forward or receded. Nothing was given precedence. The seashell alone stood on its own, separated from the other objects by a narrow channel of pure vermilion, while all the others were linked. They related in the same way as the figures forming a garland in the dance of 1910, which create a powerful concatenation of joyous capers, but for two hands that do not quite reach one another, like the index fingers of God and Adam in Michelangelo's creation in the Sistine Chapel. They almost meet, but do not touch, thus creating tension and suspense. The painting she's referring to there is this one. People dancing around, those two hands in the front, not quite touching each other there. We'll get back to that in just a second. I must have looked absorbed and thoughtful because as we came out of the museum, Pablo concluded the visit by saying, "So you think it works, this juxtaposition of objects without cause-effect relationship?" Matisse is a magician. His use of color is uncanny. This makes me hungry all of a sudden. Let's go and have some tea and toast. He just kind of shoved it aside. Couldn't deal with it. But they had a love-hate relationship, Picasso and Matisse. They reached a level in the art world unparalleled by anybody else. And at one point, Picasso said to Matisse, he said, "You know, there's things that you and I can talk about that I can't talk about with anybody else. They're on a different level. And when one of us dies, the other will not be able to continue that conversation on with anybody else." So they often stole ideas from each other. And yeah, it was an interesting relationship. But, you know, Picasso, as great of an artist as he was, still couldn't get quite sometimes what Matisse was able to do, and vice versa. So, all right, so back to this painting, The Dance. You can go see this, I think, in St. Petersburg in Russia. A little bit farther of a trip, harder to get to. But this has, you know, a lot of times he would simplify the forms down quite a bit and just play with the colors. And the abstracting of the figures was often the result of how much of that color needed to be in a particular space, balancing out. You know, some colors have a certain intensity and others not, and the relationships between them. You know, there's kind of like an intuitive visual balance between the strengths of the colors that he was subservient to more than the need to depict something accurately, quote unquote. But there's an aspect, so if you take some shapes, I just put some together here, exact same colors, but the colors are arranged differently. You'll see it has a profound effect on visually what these shapes look like. Right? Like the top one to me, that middle section stands out and almost like a pyramid jutting forward. Whereas the bottom one, you almost kind of have like, I don't know, a couple of those pyramids kind of jumping out, you know, different places just by the arrangement of colors and which color is next to which other color, right? And so you kind of have that in this painting, to where this kind of red-orange and the blue, right, they really just like pop off of each other. And so the figures, primarily with the blue background, are much more animated, whereas that green and that kind of reddish-orange, they're a little bit closer in what we call saturation, I think. And there's not as much of a contrast between those. And so the figure that's kind of primarily with the green background, kind of getting dragged along, not quite as animated. So playing around with this idea of what do the effects of colors next to each other have, and how do you reinforce that with the forms that you're using, and create this kind of rhythmic expression there. All right, so some other pieces by Matisse, and you can just see the color is what stands out more than anything. He was also really interested in pattern, which I mentioned, you know, when you're looking from the top of the Eiffel Tower or from an airplane or a window in an airplane, right? Perspective goes away and you have patterns and shapes down below. And so he would often take these floral motifs and just kind of work them throughout the painting that were kind of tablecloths and wallpaper, but at the same time just, you know, one and the same visual motif going through. All right, kind of a lengthy quote from him about how he approached this. So suppose I set out to paint an interior. I have before me a cupboard. It gives me a sensation of bright red. And I put down a red which satisfies me. Immediately a relation is established between the red and the white of the canvas. If I put a green near the red, or if I paint in a yellow floor, there must still be between this green and this yellow and the white of the canvas a relation that will be satisfactory to me. But these several tones mutually weaken one another. It is necessary, therefore, that the various elements that I use be so balanced that they do not destroy one another. To do this, I must organize my ideas. Very left brain idea, right? The relation between tones must be so established that they will sustain one another. A new combination of colors will succeed the first one and will give more completely my interpretation. I am forced to transpose until finally my picture may seem completely changed when, after successive modifications, the red has succeeded the green as the dominant color. I cannot copy nature in a servile way. I must interpret nature and submit it to the spirit of the picture. When I have found the relationship of all the tones, the result must be a living harmony of tones, a harmony not unlike that of a musical composition. So, still a very left brain analysis of what's going on, but what he's analyzing are, you know, color sensations and relationships between these colors that need constant modification in the painting process until that harmony is achieved. Yeah.
So the process then, do you know a little bit more about the detail, like when you then paint over some of the like the red with the green or something like that? Would it evolve?
Would the process evolve as he was painting and paint over one color with another?
Yeah, quite a bit. And even slightly different reds or greens to where, you know, like what he said, when we put the red down, there's a relationship between the red and the white of the canvas. You put another color in, all of a sudden there's a different relationship. And if you want the red to pop out, you either need a different red or you need it in a different amount than the green. And so, yeah, there's a lot of painting over, scraping off, recoloring, changing the shapes a little bit so you have different amounts of the different colors. And so, yeah, it's a very much a, you know, paint, look at it, see if it's giving the right feeling or sensation that's matching what you were thinking and feeling. And if not, then you keep adjusting, yeah.
So I'm not saying that you're Matisse. but to give people kind of a visual, if you remember when Michael painted during the sermon, he did that. He had colors that were very similar, and I had somebody come ask and say, how come he just kept painting the same color over? Well, as you watched it over time, it actually was a very subtle, he was adding this color to see how it interacted with the other color next to it to give emphasis into play. Mm-hmm. So like, as he's talking about that, if you can remember when he was doing the painting, he was doing what he's talking about. So that's just a visual.
Yeah. Yeah, and on that Sunday, I don't know if you guys are remembering, I wish I had a picture of it here, I had a little bit of yellow at the bottom. There's like a black strip and then a little piece of yellow in there. When I re-showed it and talked about it that next Wednesday during mid-reach, I actually came in a little bit beforehand. I added more yellow around the picture because when I stood back and looked at it, that one piece of yellow just really stood out, and I wanted it balanced out to where it wasn't all concentrated in one place. So things like that happen. And often these pictures may take months sometime to paint. And it's not that they're constantly painting for months. It's just they have it off to the side and they're looking at it. And it's not quite right, but they don't know what to do with it yet. And a couple weeks or a month later, figure out, oh, let me try changing this or changing this. And so, yeah. All right, a couple other of his pictures. It corresponds to my sensations. What I'm looking for is an interplay of color that carries my emotion. In the end, I just want the interaction to culminate in a unity that radiates light. And I think that's a pretty fitting end to it. So, ways of seeing, I don't know. We're kind of out of time, but I hope this helps you see things perhaps a little bit differently. I know when I look at Picasso and Matisse and any good artist, it just sets my senses afire. And when I go outside, the colors jump out, the shapes. I mean, looking at good art helps you look at everything else in a new light, and really enriches that experience. So, all right, thank you very much.